Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today on this episode of Evidence and Answers, we will journey back to the time of Jesus. Today's message features Dr. Joseph Holden and Dr. Pat Zukeran as they investigate powerful archaeological discoveries from the Pool of Siloam that will bring the New Testament to life. Learn how recent excavations continue to affirm the gospel narrative and the rapid spread of early Christianity. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled Archaeology Connected to Jesus. And you'll also find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or just listen online. Now let's get right into the conclusion as we defend and discuss unchanging truth in changing times.
But at the Mount of Olives, there's a storage facility there where there's dozens of ossuaries that they're still studying.
Amazing. And one of these ossuaries, I know, and it's controversial because it could be tied to James or another family member, but it's kind of inconclusive in some of its, you know, what it's proclaiming, or at least there's two different sides to this. But what really, with further study of these ossuaries, we really get insight into the burial practices of first century. So very, very, very good. And thank you for that, Pat. Well, Joe, Pat mentioned tombs. And of course, we can't leave any kind of evidence or archaeological insight unless we explore the most famous of tombs, and that is Jesus's tomb. So like these various ossuaries, what are some of the ideas, thoughts surrounding which is the actual tomb of Jesus? I know there's been several reports of different ones, but provide some insight. Give us some thoughts onto what you think.
Well, there's two leading sites for Jesus's burial tomb, and one most people know as the Garden Tomb, and then the second one is known as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And within the Garden Tomb, there is a very peaceful garden place. It's very frequented. I believe it's still owned by a British group. And this was ultimately discovered by the British general Charles Gordon as the place of the skull. It's where Christ was crucified, right next door on a hilltop that kind of has the physical appearance of a skull there. A bus station has now been built in front of it, so the appearance is a little bit convoluted now. But then you have the burial place of Jesus, allegedly there right next door to it. And, you know, this is a site where many people have frequented. It's a very beautiful site. It's well maintained and so forth. And in this site, there is a tomb. You have a burial bench and you have an opening there. And certainly that tomb was present during the time of Christ. And what we have to do when we compare the Garden Tomb along with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre option as a tomb, we have to put them up against the criteria for the tomb being qualified to be known as Jesus's burial place. And there are really about eight conditions that have to be met. I mean, the tomb had to be near a site of the crucifixion. Secondly, it had to be located in a garden. It had to be outside the city walls when Jesus was crucified there in the early 30s AD. The tomb had to be, you know, hewn out of a stone quarry. It had to be an exceptional tomb because it was a rich man's tomb, Joseph of Arimathea, of course. It had to have a rolling stone. It had to have an outer chamber and an inner chamber. And it had to be a new tomb, thus hewn in the first century there, because it says he was laid in the new tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. So of these about eight conditions, you apply these to both the Garden Tomb and the Church of Holy Sepulchre, you have the Garden Tomb largely fulfilling, with no question, about half of those eight criteria. But when you look at a few of the other half, If it's a rich man's tomb, you find that the garden tomb is very small. It's very cramped. And then secondly, if you look at the garden tomb as well, it seems to be a product of the first temple period, perhaps in the 8th century BC sometime. So it doesn't seem to be a newly hewn tomb, though it was hewn from a quarry ultimately. And, you know, when you compare these different things with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, these conditions, and it satisfies about half of the 8 conditions, because part of the burial tomb at the Church of Holy Sepulchre is missing, but you do have an outer chamber present with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You seem to find that it was a new tomb hewn in the 1st century AD. It was outside the city walls. It could qualify as a rich man's tomb. So there's all kinds of ways in which you can piece together the Church of the Holy Sepulchre too. So not all the 8 conditions actually are neatly applied to either the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or the Garden Tomb, but it seems more of them can be justified at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Today, if you go to visit it, it's run by different denominations of churches, and ultimately, it's probably the correct place of Jesus's burial. It's most likely, if I had to choose, it would be the Holy Sepulchre, even though it's not a great place to go and sit and sing some worship songs or have communion at, because it's been turned into kind of a place of superstition and all the things and the accoutrements that go along with religion are present there. So if I had to pick, it would be the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So even Hadrian, just on this last note, Emperor Hadrian in the early 2nd century AD marked the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as the traditional site of the burial place of Jesus. So we have a little bit of tradition that backs that up. We have archaeological evidence. We have things that point more appropriately, I think, to the Holy Sepulchre as the actual tomb itself.
Great information. Thanks for that, Joe. And it really shows us that more archaeological work needs to be done on these areas. So we're championing the case for biblical archaeologists. Come to Veritas, learn more about biblical archaeology, and maybe one day, if these opportunities open up, you could dig on some of these biblical sites. So appreciate that. Well, Pat, we've covered some ground. We've covered a mosaic. We've covered some graffiti, the ossuaries, and Joe just looked at Jesus's tombs. And these are things that archaeologists discovered in the past, but there's still current work happening. My question to you is, what current archaeological excavations are going on that may shed light on Jesus's life and time?
Yeah, you know, building on what Joe just spoke about, yeah, they have done some recent excavations on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You know, and as Joe stated, there's two competing sites for Jesus' tomb, the Garden Tomb and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I agree with Joe. I would favor the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as perhaps the burial place of Christ. This has been the traditional site of Jesus buried. The tradition goes all the way back to the 1st century. And as Joe mentioned, when Hadrian put down the revolt of the Jews there in about 130 AD, he wanted to stomp out Israel and Christianity. And he went to many of these sacred sites that the Christians had marked and knew were sacred sites. And he put Roman temples or altars on these sacred sites. And here at the burial site of Jesus, he put a temple to Jupiter on it there in about 130 AD. And it was later, when the Emperor Constantine became a Christian in the 4th century, he sent his mother, Helena, and she went down there to find these Christian sites. And the locals knew this is the burial site of Jesus there. And so she removed that temple to Jupiter and marked that as the burial place of Jesus and put a church there. So that tradition goes way back. Well, in 2019, the three religious groups that run the Church of the Holy Sepulchre there, the Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and the Armenian, they agreed to replace the floor tiles there. And this gave archaeologists the opportunity then, they've been long waiting for, to do some excavation at that site. And one of the most significant discoveries is that under the tile there, as they studied the soil there, they found remains of olive trees and grapevines and seeds of plants. And so they discovered that indeed there was a garden there. And it confirms what John says, that where Jesus was buried, where he was crucified, was there in a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb which no one yet had been laid. And so there's indeed a garden there. So that gives a stronger evidence that perhaps indeed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was in a garden, and perhaps it builds that case that that is the garden tomb of Jesus. And another significant discovery made in 2004 was the Pool of Siloam. And this pool is famous because this is in John 9, where Jesus healed the man blind from birth by rubbing, you know, spit and mud in his eyes. And this location is also connected with the Old Testament. It's at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel. We talked about that a few weeks ago. 2 Kings chapter 20, Hezekiah made a tunnel that connected the Gihon Springs and brought the city into Jerusalem here. And it emptied at the pool. And the pool was called in Isaiah chapter 8, the waters of Shiloah, or the pool of Shelah in Nehemiah chapter 3. And in John, it's the pool of Siloam, John chapter 9. And in 2004, you know, workers working on a sewer line south of the Temple Mount uncovered these ancient stone steps. And these were large stone steps. And it indicated that they had discovered a large stepped pool with three sides lined with these broad stone steps here, which was discovered. And it quickly became clear to archaeologists that they had discovered and found the Pool of Siloam. And so this pool is dated to the Second Temple period, and it's a large rectangular pool with stone steps descending into the water, a huge pool that could hold large numbers of people. Scholars believe that the pool may have been about 200 feet wide. And so this pool likely served as the mikveh, the ritual purification pool for Jewish pilgrims. So pilgrims traveling to the temple would purify themselves in the pool here and then walk up the pilgrimage road to the temple. And that brings us to another recent discovery that was made. There was discovered a stepped street used by pilgrims. It was uncovered leading from the Pool of Siloam to the Temple Mount here, which was found on the north side of the Pool of Siloam. So it was paved and well cut and very nicely dressed with limestone. And the stonework shows that it was a first century paved street along the western wall of the Temple Mount. So this was the walkway that was used by pilgrims that led from the Pool of Siloam, where they would do their purification and bathe there, and then go up this pilgrimage road here to the Temple Mount to offer sacrifices there. So that's another great discovery, and maybe one that's lesser known, maybe this is the last one I'll cover here, is the city of Sepphoris. It's a Galilean city near Nazareth. They're doing excavations there, and it is one of the largest and most important cities in Galilee during the time of Jesus. And it's not far from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. It's about maybe 3-4 miles from Nazareth. And it's never mentioned directly in the New Testament, but it's close to the city of Nazareth. And Nazareth, you know, it's a small little town. And it says that Jesus was a carpenter here. Well, Sepphoris was the capital of Galilee, an important administrative and cultural center. And it was destroyed but rebuilt by Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, during the time of Jesus. He's the son of Herod the Great. We read about him in the Gospels. And, you know, the Jewish historian Josephus called Sepphoris the ornament of all Galilee. So it was a nice built city. It contained government buildings, wealthy homes, markets, and workshops, and a theater. And so it's right around the 4th century BC, after the death of Herod the Great, that Sepphoris was destroyed. But Herod Antipas rebuilt the city and did massive construction work. And so the construction work occurred during the years of Jesus as he's growing up in the city of Galilee. And if you remember, Jesus is a carpenter, and most likely it means, you know, the Greek word there, tekton, means a builder or a craftsman working with wood, stone, or construction materials. So since Nazareth was a small city, many speculate, and it's a very reasonable conclusion here, that perhaps Joseph and Jesus walked and worked in the city of Sepphoris, which wouldn't be too far away there. And so this city here helps us understand the life of Jesus, in which he grew up. He grew up right near a major city or urban center. Galilee may not be the hick town that we grew up thinking it was. It was economically active and culturally diverse, and there were builders and craftsmen working on some significant construction projects during the time of the first century right there. Anyway, those are some discoveries that people are still working on.
Yeah, and it really is fascinating. I mean, just to think that they may be, you know, have archaeological excavations on the site that Jesus maybe worked on as a young man really, really is provocative to think about that. And thanks for that, Pat, a great overview. And of course, there's more. And it just underscores the importance of biblical archaeology. We need more biblical archaeologists. We need people trained and going out into the field and giving evidence for the biblical record. Well, Joe, we only have a few minutes left, but I thought it would be interesting maybe to conclude before we get to our books with some archaeological finds that go beyond the Holy Land. And why I mention this is just because what we do get from the biblical record, Acts particularly, is that Christianity spread fairly rapidly throughout the Roman world. And so it would go to suggest without reason that we should find archaeological evidence of Christians beyond the Israeli area. So I just throw this out to you quickly. What does the archaeological evidence show us about the Christian faith and how it spread?
Well, it shows us that the faith spread very quickly over a short period of time. In fact, when the book of Acts tells us that it would start in Jerusalem and then spread to Judea and Samaria and then to the uttermost parts of the world, we find with every twist of the archaeologist's spade and every new news blurb that comes out, we're finding more evidence that Christianity rapidly spread from Israel into all parts of the world. For example, the Frankfurt silver amulet, it's dated to the 3rd century. It's 1800-year-old silver amulet with a Latin inscription invoking the name of Jesus Christ on it, and it provided early evidence of Christianity spread north of the Alps into the Frankfurt area. And then there's the Armenian 4th century church that was unearthed just last year, and it shows how Christians began to develop and organize spaces shortly after adopting the faith. They started to meet together in locations. Or the Judean desert pilgrim mold that dates to the 6th and 7th century AD. It was a little limestone mold for producing souvenirs for those who traveled to the Holy Land, and they could bring home a keepsake. Well, they found this mold in northern Iran. It's called Hyrkania, and this is a place where early pilgrimage, people would come all the way from that territory and bring a home, ultimately a keepsake. And then you have submerged basilicas under Lake Iznik in Turkey. It dates to the 4th century, and it gives us insight into early Byzantine worship and burial customs and so forth. So think about this. Christianity spreads all the way to Turkey, goes north. That shouldn't surprise us because Paul's missionary journeys covered the Turkish region with the gospel, and many churches were set up. You had Antioch of Turkey, not the one of Syria, but Antioch. You had Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, the churches of Colossae, Galatians, and of course the 7 churches of Revelation Revelation chapter 2 and 3 speaks about. And then you have other things that crop up, such as the Ethiopian Basilica that dates to the 4th century AD. And that was found in the Horn of Africa in northern Ethiopia. It's the oldest known church in the sub-Saharan African area. It features a pendant with a cross and all these various Christian symbols and so forth. That dates to the 4th century. So the gospel was really getting out there. And as we know, the disciples, the 12 apostles, began to spread and to preach the gospel. And those that they reached began to spread the gospel. And before you know it, the gospel has gone all around the world, with scriptures being translated today. The Wycliffe Bible translators, I believe there's some 2,500 languages still left to translate. So the work is still cut out ahead of us, but the gospel continued to spread even during those pre-Islamic times.
And that really is just mind-boggling, because let's just take that Frankfurt silver amulet that you mentioned first. I mean, that is early as 230. So it goes without saying that Christianity had come into that area prior to that, mm-hmm. shortly after Jesus' death and resurrection, enough time for someone to make this amulet, which is time-consuming of itself. It really is, as you pointed out, Joe, shows how Christianity spread quickly. And that amulet was found north of the Alps. So this is into what we would know modern day Europe. So really, really fascinating. Well, we're concluding our time together. And as with all of our episodes, we encourage our listeners to dig deeper into the topic. So, Pat, what books would you recommend on the archaeology surrounding Jesus's life and times?
Yeah, well, there's some great books by Shimon Gibson. He is a great archaeologist there on New Testament. But a couple I really like, especially for those just getting into archaeology, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels by Craig Blomberg, and The Historical Jesus, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ by Dr. Gary Habermas, two friends there. And I think their books are outstanding, especially for those getting into New Testament archaeology. And if you want to go deeper than the books by Shimon Gibson, I would say take you to that next level.
Yeah, and what was great about Shimon Gibson, you know, Veritas just sponsored our symposium that you were at, Pat. Shimon Gibson was one of our presenters. Obviously, gives always unique and very fascinating insights. So on that. So, Joe, what books would you recommend on Jesus's life and times?
Well, again, Shimon Gibson is excellent. He wrote a book called Beneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for our listeners who want to learn more about this whole burial in the tomb of Jesus. In fact, it was Shimon that actually presented a lecture at the VIU Archaeology Symposium a couple years back that talked about the crucifixion location as being toward the Mount of Olives on a main highway or an artery coming into the city, because they would be crucified in very highly visible areas as a warning to not cross the Roman government. So Shimon Gibson has some great works on this, and also a recently published book that's written for the masses. It's called Excavating the Evidence of Jesus by Titus Kennedy, who is an archaeologist himself. Or Craig Evans, his book titled Jesus and His World, can be very helpful to our listeners in this regard.
Yeah, and Craig Evans also just spoke at our archaeological symposium as well. So if you were there, you understood how important some of these guys are. So, Joe, Pat, thank you guys so much for joining us. Join us next episode as we investigate the Armana letters, the Hittites, and the city of Megiddo. Until then, may the Lord richly bless you.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586, or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio free to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.